Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
It took Austin 34 years to name the man who killed 4 teenage girls in the yogurt shop in North Austin. His name, Robert Eugene Brashears, a serial predator, turns out. Yeah, serial predator in this case. Already linked to multiple rapes and murders across the country, he died by suicide in 1999, long before anyone connected him to the case. But the real story isn't just how they solved it. It's how they didn't, how investigators locked onto 4 innocent young men, how 2 of them were convicted, 1 sent to death row based entirely on confessions that never matched the evidence. How DNA that excluded them was ignored, downplayed, or twisted to fit a theory the state refused to let go of. It's a case about tunnel vision, about coercive interrogations, about prosecutors doubling down even when the science told them they were wrong. It's about what happens when you let the need for closure override the need for truth. We're not just talking about the yogurt shop murders. We're talking about what it reveals about the system itself and the lives that get crushed when that system refuses to admit it was wrong. Joining us now is defense attorney Bob Mata, host of Defense Diaries and someone who spent his career fighting the kinds of tactics that wreaked havoc in this case. We're going to break down how 2 innocent men ended up in prison, how the courts failed to stop it, and how many more cases like this are still buried in evidence lockers across the country today. Bob, as always, welcome and thank you for joining us. When you see a case like this where the system locked onto the wrong guys and absolutely did not look back until it was forced to, what does it tell you about how we chase resolution over truth?
Well, sadly, that's just a reality of what we're dealing with the criminal justice system these days, because at some point in time, it became less about justice and the search for truth, and it became more about winning. And I think the biggest problem that you have from the prosecutor's side of the equation is the fact that they're elected. It's a political position. Mm-hmm. And when you have a political position, you know, and you're having to run for election, you're going to try to beef up your resume. Mm-hmm. Okay? And if you're running for prosecuting attorney, tough on crime is the way to go. You know, like that's the way they've always said how you win the position. So, and what is tough on crime? Oh, well, you know, my conviction rate's 98%. Mm-hmm. And the exclusion of the truth. So that's just a sad fact. Mm-hmm. That is an absolute reality that no one is going to ever convince me otherwise. That is one of the primary issues with our system these days. And that is not to say in any way, shape, or form that I don't think that there are amazing prosecutors out there that are doing this the right way, that really do, you know, care about the truth, and that's what they're – but at some point, you know, you come in, because I think it's probably a lot like when you come in on the defense side of it and you come in as a young lawyer, you're bright-eyed, you're bushy-tailed, You know, you think I'm going to change the world. I'm going to change the world from inside, only to get bitch slapped and realize, all right, you know, this system's been set in stone for a long time, bro. You ain't doing shit, you know? So you're in there trying to one time it. And I have a feeling that a lot of prosecutors go into that job, you know, same way, but on the opposite side of it, just saying, look, I'm here to do right by victims and to bring justice to the families. And, you know, so you go in with all the best intentions, and then like anything, the bastards just grind you down, you know? So ultimately, when you see a case like this, and it's two sides of it, right? It's like the law enforcement and the prosecutor. It's both. It starts mm-hmm. with law enforcement. And, you know, when you look at the yogurt shop murder case and you're thinking about it, it was like a hard-on cop that just decided for some reason that these four kids had done this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just a fucking total hard-on cop that had no evidence to suggest it, just like came up with this concept. Oh, it's the Creek kids. Mm-hmm. It's Creek fucking people. That's what makes sense. I mean, and the guy locks into it, and then they start using Hector Polanco to start fucking extracting confessions from these kids, man. And it's like, yeah, it's scary is what it is, Tony.
And it's scary because at the same point, if you look at that group of folks who were doing the investigation at the time, I don't think that they were sitting there going, we're going to get these kids convicted. I don't care if they did it or not. I think they believed that they were doing was right. I think they thought that they were actually, well, the kids confessed. They must have confessed. They confessed. It's real. That's it. Then they get their blinders on, and there's no room for any other way of thinking. But I don't think they were sitting there nefariously going, let's just get these kids and call it a day. And that's the scary part, when you actually believe your own myth, your own bullshit.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, if you watch the documentary, you can see, you know, especially the main two guys, right? The first two investigators were just a couple of guys that were really trying to do everything in their absolute power to try to solve this case for these families that, mm-hmm. you know, in this case that devastated Austin and Texas in general, but Austin in particular. Yeah, no, there is no doubt in my mind that in terms of trying to get it solved, that when they kind of landed on these kids, but remember, it wasn't those first two guys.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about here, those first two guys that are still tight with all the family, you know, and it was well known that Polanco was the cop who would extract false confessions, mm-hmm. you know, like for quite frankly, I was a little bit shocked. Not only that, one of the cops kind of threw one of the other cops over, and I understand that. And I don't know if Polanco is still with us or not.
Mm-hmm.
But when you got another cop saying, yeah, this guy was infamous for getting innocent people to confess to shit they didn't do. And that's one of the other cops. I mean, if I'm a lawyer out there and.
But at the time, was it viewed as that, though? I mean, yes, retrospectively, we can look at it and go, he got people to confess to shit they didn't do. At the time, they're looking at it as he's the guy who gets confessions out of people.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, yeah, it did matter. It mattered to some of the cops. Like, that's what I'm saying. I forget what his name is, John Jay or whatever. Yeah. He's one of the most prominently featured cops in there. You know, the guy who really, really haunted him. And he's like, I'm still thinking about it. The guy with the striped shirt, right? Like,
sure,
like when this shit gets
off. Yes,
I was looking for him online yesterday to see if he wore his shirt again.
He did. I saw a video earlier today and he did. He did wear the shirt.
Yeah, that dude, man. No, like he knew. Like he was an intellectually honest cop,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he had problems with them looking at these kids. He didn't think that these kids were the right call. And ultimately they moved him off the case,
you know,
because of his kind of resistance to what they were putting out there in terms of how they thought this case went down. So, I mean, cops are just like anybody else. They're individuals. There's always going to be, differences in opinion, just like any other job. But, you know, ultimately, you know, what happened here was they get locked in on a concept, on a theory, mm-hmm. and it's really, really hard to get them off of it, you know, and ultimately, and then it started with the cops there, and then it moved up to the prosecutor's office.
Yeah.
Like, it's a compelling story, and the River, the Creek kids, you know, they sound like fucking nefarious little motherfuckers, and let's hang it on them, you know. It's but like the problem is when you don't have any evidence.
No
matter what your intentions are.
They were able to coerce a confession out of them, and then you got a community that's seething to find somebody.
I was just gonna say that.
And if you go, the River kids did it, of course the River kids did it. And you're basically running on hysteria.
Totally.
And hysteria is not fact. Hysteria rarely ever produces anything out of it that is tangible or meaningful once the hysteria calms down. But unfortunately, it's like, well, here we got it out of the hysteria. It's fact. And that's a scary thing. 18 hours to get Michael Scott to confess. Robert Springsteen confessed after 5. Neither had legal counsel present. Both later recanted. We look at this. This happened in the very, very early 90s. Have things changed all that much in the United States of America in terms of getting confessions out of people?
No. Next question.
Yeah.
No, they haven't. I mean, it's... I mean, the Reed technique, I think, should be outlawed. Look, they're always going to be able to come into an interview and lie to you until the Supreme Court, you know, reverses that ability to be able to do so. Because right now, you know, and they can't lie about certain things. Like, they can't say if you just confess to me right now, I'm going to make sure I'm going to walk you out of here. We're not going to charge you. You know what I mean? Like that.
Yeah.
Like, if you're talking about some kind of immunity deal, that's going to be brokered by a prosecuting attorney, not a cop. But I mean, they can certainly come in and say, hey, man, you know, we got your fucking homie over here in the next interview room. And that is a real problem for you because this guy just fucking ratted you out, you know. So like, and you're telling this guy that, and it's all like a mind fuck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you're in there because just like. We could spend probably a full day trying to get people to understand that false confessions are a real thing. Yeah. And you know, we had Michael Scott's attorney on with us last night.
Yeah.
And he was fascinating. But you know, one of the things that we were talking about was this concept of trying to convince people that there is such a thing as false confessions, because everybody's initial instinct in terms of like being a human being is, hey, you know what? There's no fucking way I would ever confess to something I didn't do. I don't give a fuck what they're doing to me. That's what people say. That's what people think. And that is the base from where people jump off from. Like, so like everybody thinks I would never confess to something I didn't do. Like that is just, so that is where you're trying to overcome from that cognitive bias right there that I just wouldn't do it. So no one would do it, you know, but the reality is that when you get into a room with a skilled interrogator,
and
the memory and the mind, it plays tricks on you. It is very easy to fool your mind into something being true. Or some version of it being true. And it's exactly what they do in these interviews and in these interrogations where, you know, like kids come in there like, I didn't have a fucking thing to do with it. And they just suggest facts and, you know, they're dropping little breadcrumbs because ultimately the person needs to kind of come up with some version of it on his own. But, you know, obviously if they don't know any of the facts of how it went down, it's very problematic.
So, Bob, where was their defense? Where were their people for these people who were wrongly accused and falsely confessed? Where were their people to come forward and say, wait a minute, no, they didn't do this. You don't have any evidence against them. It feels like that part of it fell off.
Yeah, I mean, their people ended up being their lawyers. You know what I mean? But even with the lawyers, I remember they were convicted. So then their people became the appellate lawyers who decided to continue the fight. And, you know, but in terms of if you're asking like the question, hey, Bob, where are all the witnesses coming forward at trial? Your problem here is that you're limited to, and it was a long trial. Yeah. It was a long trial. It was, you know, but the thing that ended up happening with it is you've got people that were in a very segregated area from kind of the rest of the public down in this creek. And who are you going to get to testify if they didn't know their whereabouts? I mean, because essentially what you're talking about is like an alibi witness. You know, you can't just throw a bunch of character witnesses up and talk about it unless it's somebody to talk about that, you know, this is not a violent person. You know, they got a nature, you know, but in terms of like, this is a good guy and you would never do that kind of shit. You're not getting that kind of witness on. So short of having a witness who is going to say, yeah, I'm his fucking alibi. You know why? Because I was with them last night and he wasn't anywhere near the yogurt shop. So go fuck yourself. Mm-hmm. Quit trying to get an innocent man. Bastard.
Well, I mean, there's a huge difference between an interrogator and a manipulator. Yeah. And the sad part is I think a lot of these individuals, that especially the ones that had like the really strong records of, you know, they're always getting the confessions. That's manipulation. That's not interrogation. There's a huge difference between the two. And one is actually getting information. One is making things up. But at the end of the day, if the result is looked at the same, there's a lot more incentive to have more manipulators on your force than there is interrogators. If that's going to supposedly bring you the gratification that you need and bring you the results you need in that moment, may not work out long term, but if it gets that case off your desk and gets it moving at that moment in time, that's what a lot of them are going for.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt. And this is not a situation where you're casting shade on every cop or prosecutor in the world. It's not, and we talk about this many, many times over here, man. It's
a fundamental brokenness of the system.
It just is, man. And it's like the power with a corrupt fucking cop is that they have so much power. Mm-hmm. That's what terrifies me about them is that like in the cops, like the prosecutors, like defense attorneys, I think a majority of us come into it with the right intentions. Right. And you end up just getting absolutely perverted by the system. And I don't mean perverted in a sexual sense. I mean, just like it becomes impossible to kind of find to fight the grind of it. You know what I mean? And it's like, and for cops, I mean, can you imagine how fucking tempting it is to, if you've got a case where you're like, man, I know this dude is the guy. And I just don't have the evidence to prove it. How tempting it would be just to plant one little fucking thing. Just
so your gut instinct better be right.
Well,
but even if it is right, and then you're caught planting something, and then let's say the person is it. Well, that's what's going to get them off too.
Correct.
Well, that's the whole Gacy thing that I uncovered. Like you had Gacy. You know, they didn't know he was the monster, right? They knew that they knew that he had kidnapped the last kid, and they were convinced of it.
They knew he was a monster. They didn't know he was the monster.
Right. Well, I don't even know at that point if he had slipped past just like a fucking creep into a monster in the minds of the cops, because he wasn't really on their radar, even though they like to say that. Even though he was very much on their fucking radar. If Chicago police had done their job, they would have had Gacy after the third kid, but they didn't do their job. So, but that's a whole different thing. But so, yeah, I mean, they planted the evidence in terms of injecting that receipt into that house to get back in because 10 days had gone by and they couldn't get anything on him. They fucking knew it was him. They couldn't get anything on him because the guy wasn't an idiot, and like he's not an idiot in the sense that he's not going to go out and be killing people during the time in which he's been tailed 24/7 by the police. So in that situation, somebody up top, Posenzak, makes the decision he's going to plant the fucking the photo receipt just to get them in to get the second warrant because they needed to get back in the house. So they get back in the house, and, you know, that's on the second warrant, and they start uncovering the graveyard in the crawl space. So when I uncovered that, I'm like, okay, this is a fucking moral dilemma, right? Like, mm-hmm. You've got this absolute fucking monster who absolutely needs to be stopped, but you can't get to him the way that you got to him because the Constitution has to matter. We can't pick and choose. It becomes such a slippery slope when you're like, okay, but this guy's a fucking monster animal. Mm-hmm. But we're just going to pretend like the Constitution doesn't exist for this one case because we got to take this guy. You can't do it. You just can't do it because it's a slippery slope. Because then, and the next time you're like, look, we did it for Gacy. This is basically the same shit. And then it becomes more and more. I mean, you just can't do it. You can't chip away at those incredibly important rights. And so, you know,
and it's not like they wouldn't have gotten Gacy eventually anyhow. I mean, there would have been something would have tripped it to get in there and get that information.
100%.
But they did it. They, you know, basically they warped the level. They got there a little bit faster than maybe they needed to, but obviously ultimately did get them. But do the ends justify the means is kind of the question.
Right, it can't. We can't allow it to. As much as we're tempted to say, yes, fuck him. Mm-hmm. We can't.
Yeah,
it's that simple. Like, you,
because there's a case where there's going to be a case where there isn't a graveyard in the guy's basement or under his house.
You can't set a precedent that it's okay to pick and choose who the Constitution applies to. It's that simple.
Yeah,
you can't do that. Like, there, you know what I'm saying? It's like you've if you allow that one time, you've then created some kind of precedent that, look, mm-hmm. there's exceptions to who the Constitution's not going to apply to. And to go back to exactly what you just said, because you're not always going to, they had no fucking idea this guy had a graveyard in his crawl space. None. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Zero. They were literally looking for one kid. Yeah. It just happened to stop one of the fucking most horrific serial killers of all time. So, I mean, it was a boon, you know, and they didn't get caught. Like, I caught him.
Yeah.
Gacy's dead. So, you know, it's still an amazingly fascinating and kind of terrifying story. Mm-hmm. in a global type of way, but man, you know, I mean, you can't do it, but I get why they do.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what I'm talking about. If you've got a case where you've got a guy that you just know, like the whole Avery thing with the keys, like I really do believe that they planted those keys, but that doesn't mean that I don't think that Stephen Avery wasn't the guy. And I certainly think that law enforcement in that case believed that Stephen Avery was the guy, mm-hmm. you know, and they're like, okay, this fucking guy walked out after 18 years on the last shit, even though it wasn't him. He's like, we're going to make sure that he's not walking out on this one, you know? Cause I mean, it's like, so,
or it could be that Manitowoc didn't want to pay him $1 million too. That
100%, you know, dude.
Yeah.
100%. Like,
it's a good point.
Allie and I are in the middle of that thing, and I have, like, until I've looked through all of it, I'm not reaching a conclusion based on anything that I've seen, whether it be making a murderer and convicting a murderer. I don't give a fuck. Those both had objectives going in, or soon got an objective after they started filming. So yeah, I don't know, man. Because yeah, that is more than a million. I mean, he was suing for more than a million. You know, I mean, it was a major lawsuit, and it was one that they were going to have to pay out on because he was absolutely, unequivocally not guilty of the first thing that he spent all the time on. So
what's also interesting, I mean, in the yogurt shop case here, we have Austin, we have this community, four young girls dead. Everybody is scared. Anyone who has children is thinking, well, this could happen to me. This could happen to my daughters. We need justice. We need our boogeyman. We gotta, and so they're, it's the Creek Kids. They're spooky. They're weird. In Wisconsin, it's Stephen Avery. He's got the junkyard. He's weird. He's kind of got, you know, he's kind of out there. And when you re-examine cases like this, when you look at them locally, and this is, I think, kind of a new way of doing it, because back in the 90s, unless it was a major national news story, we weren't hearing about the yogurt shop murders in Wisconsin or Chicago or wherever anybody is. Just like a lot of places was not hearing about the Stephen Avery case until Making a Murderer came out. Yep. And locally, the atmosphere, the temperature in those rooms is oftentimes quite different than any place else in the country who may be looking at it from a slightly lower temperature. I want to ask Stacy and Todd about the Avery case for a moment, because I haven't lived in Wisconsin for more than half my life now, but I was there when this all went down. What is the overall feel? What's the temperature in Wisconsin about Stephen Avery? Is it that he's guilty? Because that's the vibe I got when I made a mention of it a couple months ago on a radio station in Wisconsin. I was talking about the procedural issues with the case, and oh my God, people didn't like that. People did not like any questioning of the law enforcement on that case whatsoever. But the rest of the country is like, look at all the holes in this. Not there. Not there.
Well, I think it's because, you know, we don't want to believe that there's a miscarriage of justice right in our backyard. And so I think a lot of people are invested in this case because they know people in these communities. So I think they feel a little closer to it than a case down in Austin, Texas. We don't feel that connection to it. I do hear a lot of people talk about how he's wrongly accused. And it just surprises me.
As I brought it up on Kiss FM in Green Bay, Appleton many months ago, and got flooded with calls of like, how dare he say that this, and granted, it is the market where this happened. It is right. The Stephen Avery market. And so there's a lot of people connected to that case. I mean, I even have... It's a niece of actually a uncle of mine, not by blood, is Teresa Halbach. I was very surprised that there was the vitriol on it. And again, I don't even know what my opinion is on the case. I haven't looked at it in quite some time. I know there was Making a Murderer. Candace Owens, you can have your opinion about her every which way, and I think many do, had that other doc that came out that was more
convicting
critical.
Murderer.
Yeah, convicting a murderer, which I watched and I thought was interesting, and it pointed out a lot of the shittiness of the original doc in terms of things that were edited to be a certain way. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of questions there in my mind. Anyway, we're not talking about that case, but it is, but the point is your atmosphere is your temperatures in the room, and the pressure to convict and get your guy is such heavier, in the places where it took place, obviously, than others. And you're going to have very different viewpoints sometimes, depending on those geographics.
100%. Look, the reality is pressure makes diamonds. And when you're in a community where in something like this, and I'm talking about the yogurt shop murders, happens, you have a stunned, scared community, and there's going to be expectations. And it starts with the victims' families. And, you know, cops are like just internally feeling that pressure, you know, for the families, because they realize, you know, that the families want answers, need answers, deserve answers. And to have that kind of pressure on you as a cop, you know, it's like where you see it in shows, you know, the obsessed cop who can't sleep, who's working the case constantly, who's, you know, there's got to be the answer here. And, you know, sometimes there just isn't the answer. And sometimes you just have to really, you know, let the thing go cold and wait to see if something else develops, because what you have at the time just simply isn't going to be enough. And I think that like what you were talking about, Tony, that sometimes that the external factors may push people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do if all things were equal. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, just it's again, that political pressure.
Yeah.
Well, there's motives for reasons for people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think that it happens sometimes, you know, because it's like I'm always sitting there thinking in cases where it's just clear that they railroaded somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, and where it's so clear that they railroaded somebody, that it, the question then becomes, did you knowingly convict an innocent person just to get a conviction on this fucking thing? Because that's a hard question. You know, I mean, if ever I were to hear an answer from a prosecutor that yes, they did, that person needs to be ripped away from the job of prosecutor as quickly as humanly possible, because that is like the last type of human being you need in that type of position. Because to think that somebody would do it intentionally is horrifying.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you said, I think most of them come in with the best intentions. I don't think that typically they are trying to frame up innocent people. You know, it's
we have the attitude, obviously, we want to win. And that's kind of a toxic thing, I think, in our culture. We got to win. At what cost are we winning? Especially when it comes to things like this. Yes, you may get the conviction. You may get the person behind bars. And then the family may be able to sleep better at night because they think the bad person is gone.
But they're still out there. Justice
has been served. But not if you got the wrong person. Not if the wrong person is behind bars. You just ruined more lives. Yeah. And that victim that's dead, I can probably guarantee if they were a decent human being, they probably are not sitting wherever they're sitting now going, oh, this is great. At least everybody's sleeping well at night, but you didn't get the right guy. Like, that's not how that works. But the Innocence Project says nearly a third of DNA exonerations involve false confessions. I mean, this is obviously kind of a new thing we're coming about now with the DNA technology that exists and looking back at these older cases. Bob, I want to ask you, I mean, as a defense attorney, how difficult is it to take on a case or handle this when you are taking on a client that gave a false confession that's coming to you saying, look, they pushed me. They made me say this. This is not what I really wanted to say, but now it's on the record. And now you got that mountain to climb up as you're trying to defend someone's innocence.
It's not optimal. It's not an optimal situation. Obviously, it's one of those situations where, you know, the first thing you're going to do if you have a confession, if your client has made a statement, is you got to look at the other evidence, right? So in this particular case, you had two guys that had made statements, and one was Michael Scott and the other was Robert Springsteen. Those were the two guys who ultimately were convicted. Okay. Mm-hmm. So these guys were actually wrongfully convicted. Maurice Pierce and this Forrest Wellborn, who were the two other kids out of the four, they never actually ended up going to trial and getting convicted. So the charges were dropped on both of them at some point. But these two guys, so initially all you have is their confessions against one another that are not consistent at all, completely inconsistent with what happened inside of that yogurt shop.
Yeah.
You've got that. But the difference between Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott in this case was that there was somebody that, and I don't know if you watched the documentary, but it was kind of the tattooed blonde woman. So when she had made a claim that Michael Scott had confessed to her at a party, that she had said that he had did it. And then when the cops are investigating her, turns out, you know, she's like, oh yeah, well, he gave me all kinds of details, but I couldn't remember any of them. But they had this kind of corroborating witness here. So that Michael Scott thing was a little bit different than Springsteen, because all they had on Springsteen was Michael Scott's confession.
Yeah.
So when I have a confession thing, I'm coming in and I'm looking, what other evidence do they have? Mm-hmm. Because I assume if my client is sitting there telling me, I'm telling you, man, they bullied me into doing that thing. Like I honestly don't have a recollection of saying it, because they got my head that fucking twisted. You know, by the time that thing was done. So I'm telling you, I didn't do this thing. I, you know, you're just going to have to trust me on it. So if I have that as my baseline in terms of saying, okay, I've got to look at the conditions of the interrogation and I'm going to have to challenge that. But the other part of it is, because I don't think if you have a single confession and it's something of the nature I did it, that is a confession, that's something that I'm looking at and I'm saying, okay, I can overcome that because I'm just going to say that the cops are browbeating the fuck out of my client for 18 hours straight. And, you know, he was just saying what they needed. He thought that they needed to hear in order to let him walk out of that police station. So, but where you have the problem is where you have other powerful evidence against you, right? Mm-hmm. So that becomes a different thing. So it's like, that's really what I'm looking at. I mean, you're always going to be able to legally challenge whether or not a confession was voluntarily given, right? So, I mean, you're going to be able to have the opportunity to do that as a lawyer. It's not optimal. You know, I mean, my number one rule for my clients is shut the fuck up. You never talk to the cops. I don't care if you're innocent or guilty. You mm-hmm. don't talk to the cops without a lawyer present, unless you're a fucking moron, unless mm-hmm. you want to get railroaded, unless you want to give up some shit that you had no intention on giving up, or giving up something that you have no idea actually happened and they've tricked you into thinking that it did. Mm-hmm. So you just do not go into a police station or get interviewed by law enforcement right. without an attorney, period. End of conversation. That doesn't make you shady. It makes you smart. Mm-hmm. We in this day and age, you just have to understand that everybody's got something driving them. And when you're talking about a cop or a couple of cops, their drive is to get an arrest on something and ultimately try to get a conviction on a case, especially if it's a case that they've been investigating.
Yeah.
You know, cause like there's all kinds of crimes, like shit that they see that's going on contemporaneously. That's a completely different thing than if you're a homicide dick and you're out there investigating for years, mm-hmm. you know, and you're becoming obsessed with the case. So, the confession thing is the problem with it, Tony, is that by the time you get to trial, you're then left with trying to convince 12 people of that thing that I was talking about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
That people actually do make false confessions.
Yeah. And it's a simple fact, but it's trying to convince people of a fact that they're hesitant to believe. And that's the difficult thing with all this. In this case, in the yogurt shop case, I mean, we try to have a system of checks and balances that can weed things out, the judge being one of them. I mean, at some point when you have these cases in preliminary hearings and motions are going about, why did this get as far as it did, especially with one of them ending up on death row? I mean, why on earth did someone at some point not say, these two stories that they're both ratting each other out on don't make sense. They're not even talking about the same story. It's different stories. So how is this logical? How does this have any sort of weight? Is it, I mean, was, you know, obviously within those jurisdictions, they're on the team too of well, we want justice for our community. Is it the narrow-mindedness of sometimes the prosecutors, the judge, the police, everybody is not operating as independently as they should, where you can have the checks and balances going on?
I mean, when you say the checks and the balances, you know, when you're talking about the criminal justice system, the checks and the balances in that equation are defense attorneys.
Yeah.
We're the fucking checks and the balances.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
But within the system, if you don't want a wrongful conviction, if somebody just looks at us and goes, okay, I see your work over here, and I believe you think you're on the right path, but look, this just doesn't add up. It seems nobody wants to tell anybody their work is bad.
I know. Yeah. And it's one of those things where you're sitting there thinking about it, and you're like, okay, how do I tell my boss that this case is shit? Like, cause I have friends that have like been prosecutors and they were just assistant state's attorneys, you know, but they had a boss, and you know, I've always been trying to ask these candid questions of these fucking people. I'm like, all right, so dude, like when you open a case and you know, you open the file and you're reading through it and you realize that you have like a shit case, can you go to your, you know, boss and be like, this is like, I don't want to fucking try this case. It's a piece of shit, you know? And from the few people that I've spoken to that have been, I feel like honest to me about how those things operate. Like I, you know, they're like, no, you know, if my boss has told me to move forward on the case, I'm moving forward on the case, and I have very little ability to stop that from happening, if any. So, you know what I mean? Like, people need to understand how the politics of that office work. You know, you have young prosecuting attorneys, sometimes 23, 24, 25, no life experience. They're going in there. If they're in the felony courtroom, you know, and they're not kind of the head attorney in that room, then they're relatively new to trying cases, and they're relatively new to being an adult and being out in the world. And, you know, they don't have that life experience that is so invaluable for investigators and prosecutors both. Yes. Yes. I was dying of thirst. Thank you.
Hey, wait a minute. How do you get a delivery like that?
Where? Well, yeah, because my wife is the best. The best, baby. Yeah, sorry. Well, we do this live thing now, so it's a little more of a more casual vibe. I'm allowed to grab my coffee and drink.
Yes, you are. Ooh. I eat yogurt and stuff. Just sorry, that's probably not appropriate to eat during this segment, but it's all I have.
I know, yogurt I know. And stuff. You're always eating meat sticks. Let's be honest.
Well, meat stick.
No, today was it's yogurt.
Oh, be kind.
I did not get my meat stick today, so yeah, huge deficit over here.
Wow.
If we were to look back at this, and because obviously, and I want to talk about the folks who've gone through hell on this, and obviously now they did not do it. But, you know, the rumors have continued throughout the years, and they get looked at strange ways. Oh, I wonder he got away with this. Everybody has their judgments. Obviously, it wasn't them. So, What does the future hold for the surviving accused today? Do we have lawsuits in the future? I know that there is like a fund for people who have been wrongly accused in Texas. I believe it's like $80,000 a year they get. But I mean, come on, you stole all this time from these people, and now that they truly do have the right person, is there any now new legal repercussions or motions or moves that they can make for, I don't know, for some justice here for themselves, for the them being wrongly accused and those years of their lives stolen?
It's a 1983 claim, you know, violation of your civil rights. And there is a statute there in Texas. And honestly, I don't know what the situation is with how there's an interplay between that statute that they have and the ability to be able to bring another, like you can't double dip on it. Right. So they're going to people that understand the law down in Texas are going to have to look at it. Cause obviously now there's pretty definitive evidence that,
sure,
you know, I mean, like these guys were factually innocent and they have
been
exonerated. You know, here's the problem with it. T is like, we're talking that from, this is a case that went down in 1991.
Yeah.
Right. And like, so these guys ended up not going to trial until like 1999. So but there was this cloud, this cloud of first suspicion, and then this cloud of guilt that followed them. So in 2009 or 2008, leading into 2009, both Scott and Springsteen got out based on the Supreme Court of the U.S., you know, had dropped a new case, and it was a Sixth Amendment case saying that, look, you absolutely cannot convict somebody on the fact that you're using that person's confession without bringing that person into court so that the accused can confront their accuser, meaning the person who gave the co-confession. So in both of those cases, wherein the primary piece of evidence was the confession, neither trial did they bring in the other person so that they could be confronted. So meaning Robert Springsteen was not brought into Michael Scott's trial in order to be cross-examined, and vice versa, because they were tried separately. So that was a no-no. And so ultimately what ended up happening is both of the convictions were overturned. However, to go back to your point that you were just talking about 15 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago or 5 minutes ago, whenever it was, you know, you had these prosecutors and cops that still had bought in to their theory to the extent that they had this cognitive bias that they could not get past the fact that these are the guys. Like you've seen this clip of those prosecutors. She's like, convictions were both tossed and they were remanded for a new trial. She says, originally they're trying them again. So like there's a year period. She's like, we're definitely trying these mofos again. We're convinced that these are the guys and we're moving forward. So for a year, like when we had the attorney on last night, Carlos, he's like, I prepped for that case like a fucking savage.
Yeah.
That they were going to be taking it back to trial. And then all of a sudden, technology pops its little head in and they were able to create and pull two profiles. One at that time, there's multiple profiles now from multiple different pieces of evidence that they couldn't get because it was such a minute amount of DNA that, you know, at the tech at that point, they couldn't develop a profile. So,
sure.
So at that point in 19, as they're in 2009, the technology is advanced to where they pull profiles from both the round that was found in the drain and also one of the vaginal swabs from Amy Ayers. And at that point, they're like, oh, okay, we got a fucking problem. Like this sample, which the sample on both the round and the vaginal swab, same dude. Mm-hmm. And that dude isn't any of these four dudes. So you're like, oh, well, he's the fifth guy. It's like,
oh, we had a another one. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where you're at. And so ultimately they end up not recharging or retrying the cases. So like ultimately there was enough people back there being like, I don't know. It's like that. This he's the fifth guy thing. I don't know that that's it. I'm starting to think that these guys didn't fucking do it. But it like the way that it was publicized in Austin, and like you said, it was pretty much kind of a local case. Like I don't know, I had never, frankly, I'm embarrassed to admit, I'd never heard of it.
I didn't either. No,
until this documentary. Like, and and then I start seeing them. Like, it's one of the biggest things that ever happened in Texas, which just goes to show, you know, like I have like Texas is like an entirely, it's like an entirely different country. It's I don't know what the fuck's going on down there.
They wear big hats there, bigger hats than I've ever seen.
They even wore them to the thing yesterday.
Yeah, yes. Metro Texas.
Did you guys see the one guy that looked like Wilford Brimley sitting
there? Yes, I did. Okay.
Yeah.
It was going to be inappropriate for me to bust it and say that. I thought at that point, like,
that's
one
of the dads. That's
I was thinking that while we were watching that last hour. I'm like, who knew Wilford Brimley was still alive?
Yeah.
Man, I love Wilford. Wilford Brimley was fucking great.
And he was like, the guy looked like he was going to eat some Quaker Oats. He was ready to go.
Hell yeah. Right?
Yeah.
He was pumped. He was pumped. Yeah. You know, it's like the unmasking of who actually did this was so profoundly just. Like it was very encouraging in so many different ways for like, but like the point that I was getting to about these guys, and then I'll wrap it up on that portion of the question, is that the shroud of guilt just followed them, even though they weren't tried again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, there is no normal life for these fucking guys. And like, I know one of them moved to West Virginia but like this thing comes out. Right. And it's, you're just,
the trauma. I mean, even if people aren't recognizing you for it, it's part of your identity now.
Yeah.
And it's an identity that you never asked for. And you can't necessarily escape. And the amount of, and I believe that there was very well-intentioned investigators on this, and there were some that were just ignorant, that refused to not believe that their shit didn't stink.
Right.
And that there, I don't know what the repercussions are for that. I don't know that there are repercussions for that other than we need more checks and balances within the systems themselves to say, be able to say to each other, no, you're off, and be okay with that. And be able to retool directions of where things are going before things just barrel down one way because we're all on team blue. We're all on team whatever. It's like, let's stop being teams. Let's start being individual investigators. Let's start figuring out what actually makes sense. This is not a team sport. These are people's lives at the end of the day.
You can't undo that crap that follows, like this cloud of was it Pigpen from, you know, Charlie Brown?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
These people, when they're applying for jobs, they're trying to live their lives while this is going on. They can't. They can't even go to a convenience store and fill up their tank without people glaring at them. Their entire lives are destroyed. And it makes me question, could this happen today? Does this happen today?
Yes.
Yeah.
What are you fucking kidding?
Yeah. I want to live in the bubble where this doesn't occur.
Well, it doesn't. Then you're no better than them, Stacey. Damn it.
Yeah, Stacey.
I've only proven that today. I'm no better than anybody else.
Well, listen, I mean, here is the upside to it, but it's a slippery slope, just like anything. I mean, with the power of the DNA evidence and the ability to use IgG to kind of get over this hump if somebody's not in CODIS, right? Like, because that's what was the gap filler.
Yeah.
You know, they had a situation like here where you've got the profiles. There's a threshold for CODIS that has to be met in order for anybody, like the profile has to be good enough. They have to have at least 16 markers, right, in order for it to be listed in CODIS. So if you've got DNA from a crime scene, because there's two ways that they kind of like fill up CODIS. It's either somebody who's been arrested, and depending on what state you're in, you know, they have to mandatorily give over DNA if they're convicted. And in Illinois, it's like you have to be convicted in order to be forced, unless they compel it during the trial process.
Mm-hmm.
But it, like, and there are other states where as soon as you're arrested, they're taking a fucking swab. You're in the system, motherfucker. Mm-hmm. And the other way that they source it is from crime scene. So when they go around and they pull up swabs. So, and then all of those are put into CODIS. And then, so in this situation where you have the ability to develop the profile, they can't really, they run them through CODIS, but they're not getting any matches on it. So mm-hmm. then they start going to private databases,
yep.
like for companies that are using private databases, and they go and they're hitting all the different labs in all the country. Just mm-hmm. trying to say, okay, we have this profile. We want to see, you know, if you got anything in your system that may not have met the threshold for CODIS that's a match. And then they get this hit in Kentucky, mm-hmm. you know, like, and that's how they get the, is it Brashers or Brashears?
Seems I like wonder the same thing. I've heard it.
So fucking like fancy. It, to me, it's Brashers.
There's like a furniture store here called Brashears, and I don't know. I don't know. But and with that being said, and obviously DNA, if you get caught doing something, your DNA is going into the system for the most part today. But there's all that evidence that sits from decades past that is just sitting in evidence lockers and sitting in filing cabinets and sitting wherever it sits. And to start getting some of that stuff introduced into the system, do you think we are on the verge of seeing, I mean, we know we have started to see a lot of cold cases being solved. A lot of it has to do with podcasts. A lot of it has to do with people speaking up and saying, let's take a look at this case. And then finally some movement starts happening. People start digging things. But if we, as a system just started going, we're just going to start going through all of this and start putting it into the system. Are we on the verge of starting to see a lot of cold cases being solved?
Absolutely.
Than we have in the past. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think we're two steps away from like straight up fucking Minority Report shit.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like to your point, T, like, I think we're going to get so advanced in the technology that in terms of developing a profile, like my friends over at Othram can develop a profile in a day,
mm-hmm.
right? Like from the most minuscule amount of DNA imaginable.
Sure.
It's ultimately going to be where it's like fucking, you're going to be able to just stick a piece of evidence into a machine and it's going to boop, develop the profile right away. Like the speed in which we're going to be able to take every, like if I'm in a police station and I'm a fucking cop, I'm going to look and I'm going to say, okay, here's our cold case room. And I'm going to look through every single box. And I'm going to say, okay, in 9 out of 10 of the cold cases that we have, there is a piece of evidence that appears to have something that may in fact contain some DNA on it. But we're fucking running all of them now. And then we're running it through the system and we're going to do IgG with it. And you're going to start getting hits on it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like that's the thing. Like for all the old cases where there was absolutely no ability to be able to get a profile off stuff, and they were trying to compare blood and hair back in the old days. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have that evidence now and you say, okay, you know, it's become so cost effective for us to do it, because that used to be the rub. It's really expensive to run the DNA and get a profile. It's like, we don't have the budget to go through our 100 cold cases, because we can't spend 18, 20 grand per piece of evidence to try to develop a profile on it. When it becomes so cost effective that it costs verily nothing in order to do it, and then you're running it all through, and then you're trying to, that's the thing that's fascinating about IgG. And one day I'd love for UT to get really a DNA expert on, and we'll have an amazing conversation, because IgG is so powerful.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's so scary when it's in the hands of the wrong people in law enforcement, because nothing tells anybody anything more than our DNA does, meaning that gives up more information about us. I've been making the argument for the past couple of years that I think that we do have a privacy interest in our DNA, meaning that when they're using IgG, which is where they're finding a hit somewhere on the tree, okay, and then they're working their way backwards to see if they can work towards this person that they kind of like for it, where they have this kind of remote DNA hit. You know, you can't allow law enforcement to go in, in my estimation, without a warrant. They should they should have more. Like, IgG can't be step one. Sure. You know what I'm saying? Because then it becomes a thing where surreptitiously they're going to be trying to get all of our profiles. Because if the government had their druthers, they'd tell us, all right, everybody, today is DNA day. Everybody go to your local fucking office, and you're all giving us a buckle swab, and like, that's it. Like, we're going to have a huge database. No one's getting away with shit. Fortunately, we have civil rights in this country. We're not going to be able to do that, you know, at least at this point in time. But, you know, if you were to ask them, would you love to be able to have every human being that lived in the United States in the fucking system? They'd be like, yeah, we'd solve every crime. You know, like,
we have facial recognition out there. So,
well, and look,
it's not DNA, but our faces are identified in public places now. So we are inching closer.
It doesn't take everybody to get swabbed to be in the database, though, either, to triangulate things down. It's like at 90-some% of the population can be tracked by DNA and IgG, even if you're not in it.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, we're almost there. I mean, Yeah.
That's my point, that IgG part of it is really just family tree shit. You know what I'm saying? Yep. That's why I'm saying the baseline has to be, and this thing's going to get up to the Supreme Court at some point. It's such new technology. I thought that Koberger was going to be the case if he took it to trial.
Sure.
Because Ann Taylor made enough of a stink about it in terms of their use of IgG without a warrant, and that they had backdoored the system, that I thought that was going to be the case that would make it up to the Supreme Court. Because we do need it ruled on. We need the highest court in the land to say, okay, look, here's the deal, bro. Like, you've got to get a fucking warrant. That's your baseline. Mm-hmm. Have some probable cause in terms of some other evidence, and then come into a judge, say, all right, we want to use IgG. Okay, I see that you've collected this, and this. It's sufficient. I'm giving you the warrant. Go for it. That's fair. That's fucking fair. It can't be the first step to where they're going to just jump into it and say, okay, look, you know, the YSTR side of it, because the paternal side is, you know, we have the same DNA as our ancestors. It mutates a little bit over time, but by and large, it's the same profile. So, I mean, in order to get to that point, I think that there should be some probable cause, and you should have to come in and get a warrant. But you're right. I mean, like, ultimately, the shit's going to be infallible, because both databases, like, CODIS is not massive still.
No. It's
really not. But our total population of whatever, 350 million, it's a pittance. So, but like Stacy was saying with the facial recognition shit, I mean, we're all on the fucking grid one way or another.
Without a doubt. No. You know? Yeah. Whether we like it or not. Yeah. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Check it out. And check out that interview that you just did last night with the attorney for Michael Scott, right?
It's Defense Diaries.
Yep. Check it out wherever you get podcasts and YouTube Defense Diaries. Just search it and you will find it. All right. That's going to wrap up today's episode of the program. For Bob, for Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.